Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
The Impossible Office, marking the third centenary of the Office of Prime Minister. This book tells the extraordinary story of the office, explaining how and why it has endured longer than any other democratic political office in world history. Sir Anthony Seldon, historian of No. 10 Downing Street, explores the lives and careers, loves and scandals, successes and failures of all our great prime ministers. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, having had a very busy morning thus far. Sir Anthony Seldon, Sir Anthony, good morning to you.
Giles, it's a great honour to be on your superb programme. Thank you for having me on.
The pleasure is all mine. 300 years the Impossible Office has lasted, but there are some similarities, aren't there, between the first Prime Minister, Robert Walpole, and the latest, should we call him incumbent of the job?
Yeah, absolutely. Good name for it. Completely. I mean, there we have the first Prime Minister, Robert Walpole, and Boris Johnson. They're so alike. I mean, the book and the radio series that runs with it starts with a conversation, an imaginary conversation, obviously, between Walpole and Boris Johnson, in which they discover that they went to the same school, to the same university. They both came to power after a huge crisis, national crisis, the South Sea bubble for Walpole, Brexit. They both nearly died in their first year in office. Another extraordinary thing, they're both living with women 25 years younger, who they then went on to marry. I mean, they're both highly, high living, big character, larger than life people. So, but you know, the extraordinary thing, Giles, I've found is that in many ways, Walpole, although the country was vastly different, obviously, was doing a very similar job. He was overseeing the finances. He was overseeing Parliament, overseeing elections, overseeing appointments, overseeing government, keeping the country safe from foreign attack, keeping it secure inside. I mean, these, you know, the jobs have changed in their application, but in their nature, they're very similar. So it isn't true, as I was taught at school, that the Prime Minister's become, and many listeners, if they'd studied politics, will have done essays about the Prime Minister becoming more powerful. Not true.
And it's interesting, the fact that, you know, certain issues, you know, still ring true. There were epidemics. There was still the thorny question of Europe. And again, rebellious Scots to quell.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. So for Walpole, it was the Jacobites who wanted to restore the Stuarts onto the crown and get out the beastly German Hanoverians. And for Boris Johnson, again, it's about getting the Germans, putting the Germans back in their box, and the Europeans, and epidemics, exactly the same, economic worries, instabilities, social instabilities. you know, and keeping the job from rivals who are just wanting it. A great thing Walpole had is that he was Chancellor of the Exchequer, a job that was given up by the Prime Minister, Robert Peel, in 1841. And he was also leader of the House of Commons. So he had a lot of powers that Johnson didn't have. But, you know, they are very big and colourful characters, these prime ministers.
I mean, when you look at the fact that it's now survived for 300 years, I mean, some might, you know, when they're tub-thumping in the Palace of St. James, they say, well, this is a tradition that hasn't been shaken for 300 years. But one of the things that we discover is the fact that the reason that the modern prime minister and the modern parliament have survived is the fact that it is flexible. It has changed with the times.
Yeah, and I think that's absolutely right. It's the ability to adapt. I mean, Darwin said that the species who survive are not the strongest, but those who adapt. The people who do best in life are maybe not the mentally strongest or most intelligent. He talked about intelligence, but it is that ability to adapt. And that's what's happened with the office of Prime Minister, coupled, Giles, with the fact that, you know, if we'd had a civil war or a revolution like many European countries had, France, Spain, Germany or the United States, that would have swept away the Prime Minister. But Britain had got all that over and done with in the 17th century with a civil war and the heading of Charles I and the restoration of Charles II and the Glorious Revolution where William and Mary came, gradually chipping away the power of the monarch. And so we had a more stable body politic. But for all that, it was still remarkable, the PM. And it's happened because landmark prime ministers, I say there are only nine really historic prime ministers out of the 55, they all adapted the office in the light of changed circumstances, made their mark on it. I mean, great figures like Gladstone and Lloyd George, Churchill, Thatcher, they all reshaped the image of what the premiership was about.
And I mean, again, changing as the nation itself changed. An interesting one as well is the fact that in the past 70 years, there is only, you can argue that there has been only one game-changing prime minister, and that isn't the Blair change. It's 1979, and the first female prime minister.
Yeah, I like that word game-changing. I wish I'd used it in the book because it absolutely sums up. I think I used agenda-changing, which is actually a less good word because they've changed in a way the whole nature of the game. So look, I mean, Tony Blair was a very successful Labour Party leader, won three leadership elections, general elections that no Labour leader in history has ever done and may never do for many, many years. But he had such great advantages, Giles, of a large majorities in Parliament, a strong economy, a united Labour Party, wasn't split between left and right like it is now in the UK, and, you know, huge advantages. Did he do enough? And whereas Margaret Thatcher changed the nature of the British state, we're still living in Thatcher's Britain, whether we like it or not. We're not really living in Blair's Britain. The constitutional changes that affected Scotland and Wales were actually initiated by his Lord Chancellor, Derry Irvine. He didn't make the deep changes in the fabric of the British state that you need to make to be a landmark prime minister like Thatcher, Clement Attlee, the great Labour leader, Churchill, Lloyd George and the rest.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? And there are also those who can argue that, you know, we tend to draw parallels with the special relationship, although some may argue that that special relationship may be becoming less special. I'm talking about because of course, between the US and the UK. And there's been, if you like, a tendency to say, oh, well, the thing is with British prime ministers is that they're becoming more presidential in their outlook. You know, this use of flags, these media rooms, it's signs that the UK is going down a US route to politics.
Yeah, and Charles, absolutely. And I see that as a sign of desperation, not as a sign of power, but as a sign of weakness. I mean, if you look at those great prime ministers, they didn't have mighty number 10s. Thatcher and Attlee had quite small number 10s. They didn't try and take over the mantle of the head of state who is the monarch, they look rather stupid when they do that. Britain has a monarchy, and the most successful PMs have worked respectfully with the monarchy rather than tried to take over some of the mantle. Because the US president, let us remember, is not head of government, they're head of state. Head of state, and revered as such. They are the country in the way that we have the monarchy, and there's huge symbolic powers and authority vested in the monarchy, as we saw most recently, obviously, with the funeral of Duke of Edinburgh. So I think history would show that these attempts to be presidential have failed, and yet, you know, at the same time, you know, the powers that these great landmark figures had, Palmerston, Pitt, Peel, Walpole, Lloyd George, they were so much more powerful than prime ministers are today. And we are overdue a really effective, history-changing, game-changing, to use your word, Giles, game-changing prime minister. Haven't had one, had only had one in the last 70 years, Margaret Thatcher. Haven't had one since Margaret Thatcher in the last 31 years. And Britain's overdue. And, you know, Boris Johnson, whatever listeners might think about Boris Johnson, has some of the landmark figures or attributes of those great figures in history. They're at a time of massive change. The epidemic is a huge historical event. He was there at the time of Brexit, making Brexit happen. Again, whatever one thinks of that, that was a huge decision for Britain. He's won a landslide election victory the Tories haven't done for 30 years. So he is he has the potential to be the 10th landmark PM who come up every 30 or so years. So that will be 10 in 300 years. But they do tend to be made by events. If you want to be a historic prime minister or a historic leader, Charles, you need to be there at historic times. If it's just a fairly dull, ordinary time, there's nothing there really particularly to make your mark from. So you need to have a clear agenda, be there at historic times, and know what you're doing.
That's an interesting.
And have a bit of luck.
That's an interesting. I'd have a bit of luck in all things. That's an interesting one, because you would think, wouldn't you, that the thing that binds these prime ministers together to be a successful, to be a game-changing prime minister is to have a vision and the will to put it through, and perhaps be a fantastic orator and have the house behind you and make your impression on the people, or have something like the National Health Service, have a big idea. But you're saying that yes, it's important to have these things, but also you have to be able to react to the world around you, I suppose.
You do have to do that. You have to get it right. Some prime ministers have had the agenda thrust upon them. So for Pitt, it was Napoleon, the revolutionary wars, the Napoleonic wars against France. You know, that was thrust into the top of his in tray. For Asquith and Lloyd George, it was the First World War. For Neville Chamberlain, it was the dictators and how to deal with them. And Churchill, how to win the Second World War. So you either have your agenda thrust upon you, or you have to come up with it, like Clement Attlee did, creating the welfare state after the Second World War, or Thatcher changing Britain in the 1980s and changing its position in the world, helped by the victory, close run victory in the Falklands War. So, you know, you've got to be standing for something in the same way that if you're running a football team or a company, you've got to be there and really make decisive change happen. Otherwise, you can appear a bit grey. But you also have to have those other qualities. You've got to be a great speaker. And some recent PMs like Gordon Brown and Theresa May would not. Tony Blair definitely was, Thatcher definitely was, Churchill, Lloyd George obviously definitely were, you know, wonderful speakers who could teach the nation, tell the nation a story that they could believe in, become the national storyteller. But, you know, other factors, Giles, are often beyond your control. How long you are as a prime minister, you've got to be there for at least 5 years. Otherwise, you're toast, really. You're not going to make an impact. So that knocks out over half the 55 prime ministers who were there less than for 55 years. So for 5 years, they didn't have that chance out of the 55 to make the impact. You need to be there for long enough. You need to have a big majority. You need to have be there historic times. You need to have a long apprenticeship. So you actually learn how to be prime minister, the most difficult, powerful, complex job in the country. And most people wander into it as if they, you know, as if they know how to do it, and they don't. And by the time they've learned how to be prime minister, the time's often up.
It's interesting you go to that point, because one of my endearing images of, if you like, late 20th century politics is Margaret Thatcher leaving, you know, when the plotters came for her, and the image of her in the back of the car crying. And going through it, if you look at the surprising factor, if you look at the list of prime ministers since the Second World War, none of them has left, with the exception of Harold Wilson, who had obviously some circumstances, has left at a time of their own choosing, which I found remarkable.
Absolutely. So it's like an England batting collapse, you know, one after, I mean, England does occasionally do well at cricket too, of course, and particularly at the moment, but you know, one after another, they were scuttled out of office because they lost general elections, or because the party, their cabinet, had plotted against them, or because they became unwell. And even that one example in 1976 of Harold Wilson, he was drinking too much, he wasn't effective, he was quite possibly suffering from early onset dementia when he left in April 1976. So even the one example that people give, the books give, of a prime minister who left at the moment of their own choosing, that isn't true. It's very difficult to do it, particularly if you come in and do the office without really knowing how to do it, and without really knowing what you want to do. And so more humility, more willingness to learn, more understanding of history, more experience, more maturity will actually allow you to do it well.
Let's talk about other powers, other influences. I'm not going back to the Middle Ages and the kingmakers and Northumberlands, etc. But that, you know, we remember the famous deal struck over apparently a dinner in North London in the 90s, and that is the agreement between the Prime Minister and their chancellors. How much of a thorn in the side is the Chancellor to a Prime Minister? Has he always got to be looking nervously over his shoulder?
Yeah, definitely. So the office has become very ill-balanced. The PM used to be Chancellor of the Exchequer. The first Prime Ministers were for the first 120 years till Walpole all the way through to Robert Peel in 1841. Robert Peel then divested himself of being Chancellor of the Exchequer and overseeing the Treasury. And from that moment on, the Chancellor of the Exchequer evolved into becoming the biggest challenge to the Prime Minister. Now, for much of the 300 years of history, the Foreign Secretary, an office created in 1782, was the most significant power after the Prime Minister. The Foreign Secretary was a huge figure. So you go back to the 19th century, figures like Castlereagh and Palmerston and Grey at the beginning of the 20th century. He was the one who looked out at the eve of the First World War and said the lights are going out all over Europe. They won't be lit again in our time. That was from his office in the study in the Foreign Office. These were giants. The last giant Foreign Secretary really was Ernest Bevin after the Second World War, who created NATO and established that relationship with the United States, the special relationship that you referred to, in peacetime. It had been there in war, but not in peacetime before. So, you know, they were giants, but in the last 70 years, the office of Foreign Secretary has gradually dwindled as jet travel and instantaneous communications means that the PM doesn't have to go through the Foreign Secretary or overseas embassies and ambassadors and diplomats, but can pick up the phone and talk to President Biden, Emmanuel Macron, Angela Merkel, leaders across the Far East. You don't need the Foreign Secretary. But at the same time, the Chancellor Exchequer becoming more and more important. So Gordon Brown, you referred there to the Granita dinner in Islington on the 12th of May, 1994, if I got that date correctly, which is when Blair and Brown allegedly and accurately had a deal. And the deal was that Blair would stand first to be Labour leader. Brown would support him, but then Blair would make way for Brown. What they disagreed over was how quickly that would happen, and Brown thought it would happen much more quickly, got more and more impatient, so he undermined Blair as PM. Nigel Lawson under Thatcher squabbled relentlessly and in a rather undignified way, and then Alistair Darling, when he was Chancellor, to Gordon Brown, more fighting when Philip Hammond under Theresa May, they fought for 3 years over Europe, over public spending, over economic policy. So, you know, it's a real, I would say, Giles, it's the biggest challenge to the Prime Minister is the man next door, the Chancellor of the Exchequer.
And you make a comparison, which I think is brilliant, as at the moment the cabinet of the Prime Minister has become more like, you know, the court of the Sun King, almost like a Renaissance court with people who seem to have the same agenda. And perhaps to have a healthy parliament and a healthy cabinet, you need all sorts of divergent opinions.
Yeah, I think that I think the cabinet has become largely ineffective and unimportant. And the PM has become, tries to rule without cabinet, tries to keep as much as way out of cabinet's way, to get as much out of the way of the parliament as possible. PMs are really bored by Parliament. They'd much sooner never go there, if they were honest. They hate doing Prime Minister's questions. It takes a lot of preparation. It's very anxious-making, although they try and look relaxed, but they absolutely, I mean, several of them are close to being physically sick before it happens. You know, you're right there under the glare of the cameras, the smallest slip, and you've had it. So they try and keep away from Parliament. They don't like their cabinet. They don't trust their cabinet. They don't trust their Chancellor Exchequer. They try and be foreign secretary themselves. And they develop a court around them in Downing Street, which is like a medieval or Tudor or Stuart court, or indeed a Georgian court under the Hanoverians of the 18th century, with the same kind of figures. And if you go back, you can see in history figures like Thomas Cromwell, Thomas Wolsey, were in some ways early day prime ministers before Robert Walpole, but also they were quite like figures in Number 10, like, for example, Dominic Cummings, in the powers that they had and their sense that they could pretty much do anything they wanted to.
It's an interesting one. I know that you say in your book there's no point, different times require different skills, but if you had to sit down and spend an afternoon or be next to the dispatches box with a prime minister in the 300 years, Sir Anthony, who would you like to hear, orate, or get a glimpse of face to face?
Oh, you know, Charles, easy question. It has to be Churchill. I mean, It would be Churchill, and because he was a great artist, a great writer, a great human being. He's upset people at the moment, and some of his attitudes were very typical of people of the time and look bad today. But he was a magnificent human being. I think so many of the others could just have, you know, look back for the rest of their lives, Charles, and think, you know, look, I've had the biggest job in the country. Look at David Cameron now. I mean, how must he be feeling? You know, you've had the biggest job in the country, and you blow it. And you often blow it because you're just so busy. You're not really thinking deeply about what really matters to you and what really matters to the country. And you fritter away your opportunities, and then you spend the rest of your life regretting it.
This is the book and the series are called The Impossible Office. Sir Anthony, where can people find the book and the series, etc.?
Well, like every author, I hope, Charles, they would say support your local bookshop. Go into the local bookshop and it will be there. I hope it should be. If not, they can always order it. That's better than going via Amazon, but if you live a long way from bookshops, then Amazon is a very good way of doing it. It sold out very quickly, but it's now back in stock, I'm told, last Friday. So Amazon have more copies.
And you'll be able to download it via our own virtual bookstore as well.
Absolutely. Of course you can. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's such a great story, I think.
I have to agree with you. The book is called The Impossible Office. Sir Anthony Seldom, it's been a pleasure to speak to you this morning.
Thank you, Charles, very much for having me on. And best wishes to all your listeners.
At Ability Chiropractic, we believe every child deserves to grow up healthy, strong, and connected to the incredible power within their own body. From infants to adults, our doctors specialize in purposeful chiropractic care that restores balance between the brain and body, helping you and your family live and heal the way you were designed to, naturally. Families across Columbus are choosing to build lifelong wellness from the start. Discover what true health feels like at Ability Chiropractic. Schedule your visit today at abilitychiro.com.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.